This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Aquarium Mania. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Anong, speaking to you from the University of Florida IFAS Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory. Thanks for joining us. Fish medicine, now mainstream, became a recognized veterinary specialty through the American Veterinary Medical Association in 2023. But many decades ago, few vets treated pet fish and hobbyists were on their own. My guest today, Dr. Greg Lubart, was one of those vets. A foremost pioneer of aquarium fish medicine and both an award-winning veterinarian and author, Greg is a professor at North Carolina State University and has been my mentor and good friend since the 80s. Join us as Greg looks back on the early days and forward to the future of fish medicine. We'll be right back after these messages.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquarium Mania on Life Radio. My guest today is Dr. Greg Lubart, world-renowned aquatic and exotic veterinarian, professor, researcher, and author. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Roy. How's it going?
Good, good. I kind of gave a little bit of info on how great you were in my intro earlier, but we're going to kind of delve into all that a little bit more. But before that, I wanted to get a little personal, as I always do, talk a little bit about your early years.
Sure.
So what and who were some of your childhood influences that got you interested in nature and aquatics?
Yeah, I guess it was really my parents and my brothers, my family. We spent, from the time I was five until I was in high school, we spent part or most of every summer in Maine vacationing. I was really lucky. My dad was a physician and researcher, steroid chemist. So for about 15 years, he was on NSF funding, which meant in the summer he could take off. And so my brothers and I'm the oldest of four, we were immersed in nature from an early age. It was mostly in the mountains of Maine, but also once in a while at the coast. And I was really drawn to the marine environment. I think that is the big main influencing factor on my interest in nature and animals. And we weren't dog people, or we had a pet cat and I had a pet guinea pig. And when those animals went to the veterinarian, that made a big impact on me too.
But you took such good care of them that they probably didn't go that often, I assume.
Oh, yeah. It was 100% preventive care. If that included being hit by a car.
So now tell us about your very first fish and your very first aquarium.
Yeah, so that's a little bit of a interesting topic. I'm not a hobbyist. And when I was, you know, probably 8 or 9, I remember my mom got me a quarry catfish. And I had a quarry cat living in a goldfish bowl for a while. I don't think it was long. It was longer than a day and less than a year. We had a few goldfish, but I was never a hobbyist. I didn't keep aquariums. I didn't raise fish. And I didn't have my own aquarium until I was in veterinary school. And even then, pretty modest, couple 15-gallon tanks. And I don't have aquariums now. I have plenty of fish contact at work.
Oh, yeah. Understandable. So with that said, do you remember anything? Did you ever visit any aquarium stores back in the day, or when your mom was getting you these fish? Do you remember anything at all about how fish keeping was back then?
I do. So this would have been in the 60s, late 60s. So there weren't any chain pet stores. I think there was Doctor's Pet, which was kind of a chain, but there weren't the large stores that they are now, like the superstores. And I remember I grew up in a town called Willingboro, New Jersey. It's a Philadelphia suburb and sort of a bedroom community of Philadelphia. And we had a mall called the Plaza, the Willingboro Plaza. And my brothers and I would go every Saturday. My mom would give us each a buck. 50 cents was the movie and popcorn. And then the rest we would use at the mall for candy and things. But there was a pet store and we always went to the pet store and looked at the fish and looked at the mice and the birds. And I just remember that pet stores were kind of what we call mom and pop back then. And even when I was in veterinary school in the mid to late 80s, I worked at a little pet store in West Philadelphia after school and on weekends. And that was also a small privately owned pet store. But the owner was really good about all in and all out management and keeping fish healthy.
So let's move forward a little bit. Now, you obviously went to college. What did you study there? And were there any experiences during those years that influenced you kind of on the path that you ended up taking?
Yeah. So I was a biology major. I got a BA in biology from Gettysburg College in 1981. And really, I wasn't the greatest student to start out with. I was barely hovering above academic probation. I never did dip into that area, but I could see it from where I was. And I got more serious about school. I wanted to be a veterinarian. I knew I needed to kind of get my academic ducks in a row. And I did slowly, but it was really my invertebrate zoology course with Dr. Robert Barnes that I think it's the pivotal moment in my career. It changed things completely for me because up until the fall of my senior year, I was getting by, I was doing better, but nothing had really kind of lit my fire like invert zoo. And for the first time in college, I was the student at the top of the class. First and only time, I'll say. And in those days, Roy, they would post your name and your grade out on a bulletin board with your social security number for everybody to see. So I knew I was at the top. I was at the top because I loved it. I loved the professor, the way he taught. I loved the subject matter.
Barnes is a god, so that's amazing.
Yeah, and he taught at Gettysburg for probably 40 years, and it really changed my life. I went to the Duke Marine Lab with him on a field trip with a class. I went to Bermuda with a class. And then that all happened when I was applying to veterinary school. So my backup plan was to go to graduate school and study marine biology. And that's what I did. And my master's was focused on marine invertebrates and specifically a little polychaete worm. But it was about that time, so this would have been the early 80s, 40 some years ago, that I saw fish as kind of an untapped area of the profession. I volunteered at the New England Aquarium while I was in Boston, and I learned to scuba dive. And even though I've never had an ichthyology class, I recognized fish as being pretty cool. And then when I was in vet school and started working at the pet store, mainly to learn more about aquariology.
So, worms and then fish. Now, you mentioned earlier, I guess, that you had decided to become a vet. Sounds like maybe grade school, is that right? Or let's go soon.
I really think when I was 14, I started volunteering for a local veterinarian named Dr. Bookman. And so between 14 and 16, I volunteered. And when I was 16, he hired me. So for all through high school, I worked afternoons and on weekends at his clinic we're talking almost 50 years ago, and things were different. So I would take out the trash, hold dogs, assist in surgery, do fecals, whatever needed to be done.
That's awesome. Now, just really briefly, I guess, what were you looking at with that polychaete? I think we talked about this here. Your major professor, I ended up taking a class with many years later, I think, Trish Morris, right? which was kind of a coincidence before we kind of knew each other.
Yeah.
What did you study with this polychaete worm?
My advisor was a guy named Doc Reiser, Nathan Reiser, and he and Trish Morse, who you mentioned, were fundamental in starting the Marine Science Institute in Nahant, Mass., Northeastern's Marine Lab. So I studied mostly ultrastructure or transmission and scanning electron microscopy anatomy of this little interstitial polychaete, which means interstitial is an animal that's so small, it lives between sand grains. So these worms were maybe 5 millimeters long and, you know, 100 microns wide. And I was studying their head anatomy and some glandular structures based on my advisor's ideas and hypotheses on these. And I took malacology, the study of mollusks, with Dr. Morse.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
We took the same class probably because we went
amazing.
Up to West Quadi Head and everything. So I guess fast forward now to veterinary school. What opportunities were there in vet school when you were going through for fish medicine? And did you want to maybe mention any mentors you had at the time?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. And really, the Penn had what they called the core elective curriculum. So I started in 1984, so almost exactly 40 years ago. And we had a course that third years took called fish diseases. It was an elective. You probably had it too. I took that. And then I went to Aquavet after my second year at Woods Hole. And my mentors then were Dr. Bill Medway, William Medway, and Dr. Don Apt. And it's funny because in the early 80s, 82, 83, when I volunteered at the aquarium, and I was telling people, I'm going to go to vet school and I'm going to be an aquarium vet. And they said, well, you need to track down three people, Joe Girasi, Bill Medway, and Don Apt. And they all had a connection to UPenn. Don and Apt and Dr. Girasi were graduates, and Medway was a professor there starting in the late 50s. And they all, especially Girasi and Medway, had some of the early veterinarians, along with Sam Ridgway, working on marine mammals. But it was really hard to work with marine mammals and to get your hands on them, to even do externships or shadow as a student. So that's when I took the fish disease class and thought, you know, I don't really know a lot about fish. I need to learn. And what better way to learn than to work at a little pet store where I could see the species, learn about water quality, life support systems, and the industry. So I had some other mentors. Dr. Chuck Newton made a big impact on me, an orthopedic surgeon. Maddie Hendricks, who was a pathologist at Penn, who would oversee the fish course for a long time. Yeah, I'm glad you asked.
So we're going to go even a little bit faster forward to your first job. And I know it was kind of a really cool thing. You were a fish vet right out of vet school. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. It's fun to talk about it and look back on it. So here I am. It's April of 1988. I'm a month from graduating. And the only prospect I was applying for a NIH postdoc at Woods Hole with Dr. Apt and Dr. Lou Leibovitz to do horseshoe crab research. So I had submitted this NIH postdoc proposal that was a three-year deal, but it didn't get funded. But the pet store, Tradewinds, still there, different ownership, I think. The company that sold them fish was called O'Byrne Tropical. And a guy named David O'Byrne owned this operation. And 35, 40 years ago, we didn't have Petco's and PetSmart's. Walmart's weren't selling fish. So a lot of those other mom and pop pet stores I talk about would buy their fish from wholesalers like O'Byrne's. So they would buy boxes of fish from Asia and South America and Florida. And then a pet store, I need 20 neons and 10 plecos and 20 angelfish. And they could buy them. The wholesaler would mark them up. And I remember he was selling about $6 million worth of fish a year. And that was in the late 1980s. And so he heard there was this vet student at Tradewinds that was cutting up fish and diagnosing diseases. And he asked me to look at some of his fish, and I did. And then he said, I want to take you out to dinner and make you a job offer. And I thought, okay. So he took me to this kind of fancy men's club in Philadelphia called the Vesper Club. And, you know, I was 28 years old, and I remember having a couple gin martinis that were really good. And he said, I want to offer you a job. And he asked me what I wanted. And, you know, I'd kind of prepped and talked to my lawyer brother and friends are like, oh, man, you got to ask for a lot. You got to ask for, I don't know, a lot of money back then. And he didn't make me an offer. He said, well, what do you want? So I gave him this really high number and he didn't flinch, but he said, well, How about if we start here and I give you a $5,000 raise every 6 months? And if you're with me in 2 years, you'll get to that number. And I said, sold. And so that was it. I started in May. I graduated in May. I worked for him for a little while, took a trip to Europe, and then stayed with him for almost 5 years, including helping open his quarantine and relay facility in Naples, Florida. It was immersion, but I learned a lot.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And for the listeners, this is kind of when I met Gray after he just started the job as I was a vet student. So yeah, it was kind of a classic time for us, I think.
Oh, it was. Roy and his buddy Howard Crum called me on the phone. So for the listeners, 1988, and you've heard this if you're younger from your parents or grandparents, but that's, you know, the phone rang and it was a landline. And these two guys said, hey, we just started at UPenn. We're first years. We heard you're a fish vet. We want to be fish vets. We want to visit you. And then it struck up what's now a 36-year relationship. And I remember I kind of assigned you guys some pretty basic research projects. Like, hey, here's a fish.
Yes, I remember. I remember. Yeah.
Chop off a fin, see what it looks like. And, you know, we build on that, let's just say.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So you mentioned Naples, and that was kind of my next question was, which I thought was really exciting when that happened, and you told us about it. Tell us about why you moved down to Florida and Naples and a little bit about what you had to do to kind of get that part of the business up and running.
Yeah, so Dave was a pretty entrepreneurial guy, as was your boss for a while, Joe Diaz. They were good buddies. And you know, these businesses, let's face it, they are that. So they've got to make money. They've got to stay solvent. And Dave recognized that, you know, mortality really cut into profits, right? If you're paying to import fish and they end up dying, it's a double loss because you're paying to ship water around on airplanes is expensive. It's heavy. So I kind of set up some protocols in Philadelphia that first year. I kind of wish I knew now what I didn't know then. Because I would have been more proactive on preventive medicine and biosecurity and fish handling. I was just new, right? I was naive. But I think I helped some things there. And then Dave thought, well, we're losing a lot of fish out of South America because of the stress of shipment, crowding, disease. So he had the idea, if I build a holding facility in Southern Florida, almost all those South American fish, mainly out of Colombia, Brazil, Peru, if those fish, they almost all fly into Miami, if I can get them at the airport and rush them across the Everglades, in 2 hours, I'll have them swimming in water instead of another 12 to 24 hours being shipped around the country. And so the idea was get the fish, reduce stress, manage disease and problems, and then you'll have a much stronger product to transship, either supply by truck in other wholesalers in Florida or ship by air. And that was the idea. And early on, I would travel down maybe for a few days or a week, go back to Philly. And by the end of 1989, I was living there and only coming up to Philly, you know, every couple few months.
Now you left out the weird South American travel parts.
Oh, you mean like flying to South America?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I went to Colombia once and it was interesting. We were working on how to, again, these are businesses, right? Of course, everybody wants live, healthy fish. And so we wanted to find a way to increase the pack, more fish in a box to make the landed cost cheaper without sacrificing health. So I went down and I brought MS-222. I remember I brought like a kilo of MS-222. So I'm bringing a kilo of white powder to Colombia. And they didn't care about that at all. It's like taking sand to the beach, right? But what they did care about was my microscope. They really scrutinized that. And my Swiss Army knife. Now, younger people will be surprised, but in the 80s and 90s, you could fly with knives with no problems. I had my Swiss Army knife in my pocket all the time. But when I got to Bogota, one of the security guys looked at it and opened it and kind of held it up to his neck and made like a slashing sound, like, or movement, like you could still do that even with a small knife. But they gave me my knife. And to tell you, I love Colombia, and I felt very safe there despite the reputation. So yeah, I think that's my main South American story.
And I know, I think you had mentioned before you worked to get suppliers, obviously, out of there and did some visiting of some of the areas.
Yeah. We visited. I worked with shippers, and I went down to the Llanos, or the plains where the fish were caught and held. I had some really interesting experiences back in Naples. One guy, I won't mention his name, not that it would matter probably, but he was in the, so what happens, I don't know how it is now because I'm pretty far removed, but most of the South American shippers of fish, these are family businesses. So they'll have a family member in Miami, like a brother or cousin or uncle or aunt or spouse, and they'll handle the United States side of the business. And then they have family in South America that handle the South American side. And that seems to work really well. Well, one guy disappeared from the equation for a couple years, and then he reappeared. And I said, hey, where have you been? He said, oh, I spent a couple years at the university. And it turned out that was a euphemism for in jail. So some South American tropical fish, there were drug dealers laundering money with tropical fish. So that's how they would clean up the drug money. Not everybody, or maybe even many, but some people did that, and he got caught. And the other thing that I never saw it happen, but people would also smuggle drugs into the U.S. either inside fish, literally like little packets inside placostomus, or more commonly in the walls of the fish boxes, the styrofoam boxes. So frequently when we picked up these boxes, our driver in Miami, that the customs people and the DEA would puncture the styrofoam with blunt probes, that they wouldn't puncture the bags, but they would make sure that the styrofoam walls were not hollow or filled with anything. So it was interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't think I had heard that part, but yeah.
Oh, very... yeah. Yeah. And sometimes practical jokes are fun and funny, and sometimes you cross the line. And I crossed the line once. So my now wife, we weren't married then, she came down and decided to, she was a veterinarian, she was a class behind me. She was going to move to Naples, and her mom drove her down. The job came with a house on the property. So I've been living there. And the people, it was, there were like people building the life support systems and working on the building. So it was mostly guys living there. And so it needed some cleaning up. And I remember Diane's mom was there, and our driver had found, sometimes the DEA people would test the boxes with these colorimetric test kits looking for contraband like cocaine or heroin. And one time, at least one time, one of these kits came back in between a couple of boxes. So I had it on my desk. Well, I'm from New Jersey, so this ties in. I'm a northern kid. So Diane's mom is cleaning this kitchen, and underneath the microwave, she finds this piece of waxy paper with white powder in it. And I'd never seen it. And she says, what is this? And I said, oh, well, I have this cocaine tester here. Let's see. Well, her mom like lost it. And she's like, I'm bringing you back home. You're not staying here. And I said, no, I was kidding. I don't know what it is. So the only way she wouldn't take her daughter away is we had to go to the Naples police station. So here we go with this wax paper with white powder with no label or anything. I bring it to the Naples police station. And I say, found this in my house. My mother-in-law-to-be insists that you test it. And they tested it, and they said, it's not any contraband. It's not an illegal drug. And it wasn't until about 5 years later, and I was living in North Carolina, and I learned it was probably headache powder, that there's this stuff called like Goody's headache powder, BC powder. That's what it was.
That's funny. That's hilarious.
You can cut that out if you want.
Oh, no, that's great. Well, let's take a short break, and we'll continue our discussion with fish medicine pioneer and award-winning author Dr. Greg Lubart after these messages from our sponsors.
Begging to hear more of your favorite show? Full episodes of all our shows are available on demand. Go to PetLifeRadio.com to fetch our entire lineup of Possum Pet Podcasts. Also, dig us up in iHeartRadio and iTunes. Let's talk pets. Live and on demand only from Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
We're back, And continuing our conversation with my guest, Dr. Greg Lubart, fish vet pioneer and award-winning author based at North Carolina State University. So, Greg, I want to move forward again. And I remember coming down, working at 5D for a year, and then you told me you were moving away. So tell us about the next phase of your career then.
Yeah, well, I knew there wasn't room in Florida for both of us, Roy. So I knew I had to kind of move north. No, you know, it's funny. Even when I took the job at O'Byrne's, I thought, well, this is a job working with fish as a vet, and they're going to pay me. That's awesome. And one day I'd like to be a public aquarium veterinarian. And, you know, after a few years, and I had a lot of loans, you know, we went to an expensive vet school and I borrowed a lot. So the job was good in that way. And I didn't have to pay rent. So that helped. And I had a racehorse, and that's another story. But my mom and I adopted a little standard bred foal that was going to be euthanized. So that was a little bit of a drain on the pocketbook. But anyway, you know, I was content in Florida, but I didn't think I'd spend my whole career there. It was a little bit of an academic vacuum. We loved it. We loved that area of Southwest Florida. But, you know, I was sort of looking at WAN ads now and again. And then NC State was looking for a fish veterinarian in the AVMA journal. And I thought, well, there aren't many of us out there. I'm going to apply. So even though I was only not quite 5 years out of vet school, 4 years out of vet school, really, I applied to NC State. It had a great reputation. I'd never been here, but Michael Stoskop was here. Ed Noga was here, two of the leading fish veterinarians. And at the time, those two guys, Ruth Francis Floyd and Jack Grotzik of the University of Georgia. And Jack Grotzik was also a very important mentor for me. In fact, when I thought about taking the job in Philadelphia, I called him and Dr. Don Apt, and both of them said, "But you should go for it." But at the time, I mean, there were a lot of fish health people out there, but most of them weren't veterinarians too. So with Noga and Stoskop here, and I was lucky to get an interview. And then when I got the job offer in August of 1992, even though I had to take a pay cut, I thought this window's going to close for someone who didn't have a PhD. I had a master's, but no PhD, no board certification. I better jump through that window. And that's how I ended up at NC State.
And you've done a ton, obviously, before and since then. The next question I had for you was just kind of about some of those early years at NC State and maybe some of the holes you saw, gaps in fish medicine. What research, teaching, and or outreach efforts would you say are kind of pivotal for you in your career and are you most proud of?
Yeah. So probably the best thing about this environment for me is the whole teamwork approach. You know, I'm not a good surgeon. I'm sort of a generalist. And sometimes I kind of say I'm like a manager, like I'll manage a case. But I get a surgeon and I get a radiologist and an ophthalmologist or whatever's needed. So that this academic environment was really good for me. And I'm willing to say, hey, don't worry, everybody. This is a fish, but I can help you with the anatomy and the physiology, the pre and post procedure care, those kinds of things. So the students really drove a lot of what we did, in particular, Robert Bacall, who was a first year student when I came here. And Robert was really fearless. I knew him from an IAAM meeting even before I came here. And he would say, let's do abdominal surgery. Let's do an MRI. Let's do a myelogram. I mean, things I would never have tried. And so I think what I'm most proud of in that area is really some pioneering work. And it's not me. It's really the team here on fish anesthesia, fish imaging, and fish surgery, and along with Craig Harms, who was a resident at the time. And Craig is for sure my closest friend and colleague here at NC State, and we've been working together for almost 32 years. And so we just, I think, pulled back the curtain on some of what the limits were, or at least perceived to be. We can take a cichlid and do abdominal surgery and take part of its swim bladder out, close it up, and it'll live, or do microsurgery on a gourami and do CAT scans on fish and things that are, I'm not saying we were the first people to do those. I'm sure we weren't, but we were among the first to write up and publish some of that work. So I think I'm proud of looking at someone's pet fish, whether it was a goldfish or a gourami, and treating it just like we would somebody's dog or horse.
I have to add, and you did a lot of work, you know, kind of looking at drugs and drug studies as well, both, you know, the kinetics and the, you know, just effectiveness. Do you want to maybe talk about that at
all?
Yeah.
So, you know, I had some great mentors once I got here. And I don't know, I mean, you're in academia too. And it's just magical in a lot of ways. And some people who are more experienced and were tenured said, hey, Greg, you can be a fish vet. That's great. I know you love reptiles and you can be a reptile vet, but you're going to need discipline to kind of hang your hat on. If you're going to get tenure and advance up the academic ladder, you're really going to have to focus on some part of fish medicine. So not just taxonomic work. And I thought, well, pharmacokinetics is and pharmacology. I'm not a pharmacologist, but I knew the challenges I had in the industry treating fish, figuring out drugs and dosages and routes of administration. And I thought, yeah, that's something I could work with. And that's what I did. And we established a colony of Pacu. I remember telling Dr. Stoskov, I said, you know, I worked with these fish in Florida and in the Amazon. They're big, they're tough, they're resilient, and they're a good model because they're related to tetras and a lot of other popular tropical fish. So we had a colony of Pacu here for about 15 years that we did anesthesia studies with, pharmacokinetic studies. And so, yeah, that was, if I had an area that was a discipline, it was pharmacology.
So you also did quite a bit on the teaching side. And I remember you bringing students down here. I don't know if that was early on or whether that was a little bit later, but yeah, you want to maybe touch on a little bit of the teaching side of that?
Yeah, thanks. You know, one thing that was great about coming to NC State as a fish veterinarian is there really wasn't a roadmap for what I could do. It was expected I would do research, teach, and see clinics, but it really wasn't well-defined, which fit well for me, because I tend to function pretty well in a minimally organized environment, let's say. So I started looking at, well, what could I do and what might meet the needs of the school and what would students like? So I think in 1994, I'd been here about a year, I started an aquatic medicine rotation, a two-week rotation. And, you know, let's face it, even now, we wouldn't have fish coming in every day. So what I did is I thought, well, I'll kind of run this like an experiential learning. So if I do have fish cases coming in and they're not urgent or emergent, I'll try to hone them in on these two-week blocks. I did one in the spring, one in the fall, and one in the winter. And then we'll visit public aquariums, of which there are three in the state. And at this time in the 90s and early 2000s, there were no veterinarians working at those aquariums. Now there are two full-time vets. North Carolina is the number two trout producer, number two or three in the country, way behind Idaho, but there's a fairly substantial rainbow trout industry in the mountains. So we would go to the mountains and visit facilities, and we would go to the coastal plain and visit hybrid striped bass facilities. And we'd go to pet stores and do rounds at the pet store. And we'd go to koi farms in the state. So it was a little bit of Greg driving a big van around the state. But in the winter, there wasn't as much going on, especially with koi ponds. Every fish are pretty dormant. So I thought, I'm going to go to Florida and visit my friends there like Roy. So for probably 8 or 9 years, every February, we'd go to Florida for a week. And I'd visit Roy at 5D when he was working there, and later at the Tropical Aquaculture Facility. And we'd go to Disney and go to Epcot. And then we'd go to SeaWorld, where we had friends and colleagues. And one time I had an adventurous group. We went all the way down to the Everglades and I rented a pontoon boat and we went out for the day on a pontoon boat. But that made for a really long drive back. So that was a very popular block. And I opened it up to students from other schools, particularly Penn, because Penn already had, you know, the AquaVet connection and their fish disease course. And I maintained some adjunct status there where I would teach in that course. So if my block didn't fill with NC State students, I would flesh it out with Penn students and sometimes students from other schools too. And I probably did that block for about 15 years. I don't do it anymore. I've got more regular clinical duties, so it precludes me from doing those big two-week hunks.
So that's a little bit of a segue before we talk about writing and the book you and I put together to your Galapagos interests. Now, I know really excited students that get to go there with you during kind of scheduled visits, but you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, it's such a great profession we're in, and, you know, opportunities pop up all the time. And sometimes it's like a no-brainer. You just like knee jerk. Yes, I will do that. Sometimes maybe you need to think about it and look at your schedule and look at your priorities. And sometimes right out of the gate, it's like a hard no, like, no, I'm not really, I don't have expertise in that area. So I started working with a wonderful guy named Ken Lohman in 1995. Ken's a biologist at UNC Chapel Hill. We're the same vintage. In fact, we both took Invert Zoe with Dr. Barnes. He took it at Duke when he was an undergrad at Duke, and I took it at Gettysburg. And he studies marine animal navigation. His master's was at University of Florida, looking at lobster navigation. His PhD was on salmon at University of Washington. And then he came to UNC Chapel Hill around 1991, and his research, he was looking at marine invertebrates like a sea slug called Tritonia, and he also was started working with sea turtles. And when he had some sick Tritonia, he called me, again, telephone. I hear you might be someone who can help me with these sick mollusks. And I met him, and it's all about relationships, right, Roy? You know, going over there, at least trying, showing interest and some passion. I brought Andy Stamper with me, actually. Andy was a resident then. So that tracks it to around 1995, 1996. I'm not sure we helped him, but we had a relationship. And then 2003, it's 21 years ago, he started bringing juvenile sea turtles into his lab to study navigation in a non-invasive way using magnetic fields and little harnesses. And I'd always had an interest in reptiles and amphibians, and NC State allowed me to pursue that. And so when he needed a vet for his sea turtles, I became that person. So once or twice a year, I would go to Chapel Hill, bring students, do physicals, and he would keep these turtles for a year. It was sort of a combo head starting program and research program. And this went on for 8 or 9 years. We'd have lunch, how's the family? And around 2011, he said, hey, I've been going to the Galapagos. And my ears kind of perked up, and I said, oh, what's happening there? He said, well, we're building a science center with a school in Quito. I said, well, if you ever need a vet, he said, okay. And then 2012, he said, hey, Greg, this stuff you're doing with my sea turtles, physicals, vital signs, collecting blood, could you do that with wild sea turtles in the Galapagos? I'm trying to get some research off the ground. And that was like a knee-jerk no-brainer. He didn't even have to finish the question. And before I even thought how I would do it, I said, yes. So I made my first trip there in 2013. And Roy, you were there this year. I mean, I don't think anybody that goes to the Galapagos is disappointed.
And no, definitely
doesn't
not.
doesn't want to find a way to go back. And so I've been there 28 times now. And very modest beginning, going with Ken, just the two of us. We did our sea turtle research, but I started establishing relationships with the Galapagos National Park and other scientists. And now I think I've worked on 25 species there. Our NC State team and colleagues have published about 40 papers. And truth, funniest thing, the only thing I've done with fish in the Galapagos is eat them. So I'm involved in some fish projects, but I've not been hands-on because of either the pandemic or I've been needed to work on sea lions or seabirds or tortoises. So, and I tell my students, I didn't even go to the Galapagos for the first time till I was 54 years old. So that's what's great about this career. You don't know where it's going to take you, but if you work hard at relationships in a sincere and transparent manner, it's going to take you to cool places. And I think you found that this year. And one other thing, I think it came at a great time for me because I'd been at NC State for 20 years. And I won't say I was getting bored, but I think I was sort of looking for something a little different. And the Galapagos kind of dropped in my lap. And then, as you mentioned, I've taken about 140 students there. Every spring break, I bring between 20 and 32 third-year vet students. And not only do we go, it's very intense. We're only there on the ground about 7 days, but we do field research too.
Yeah, I've definitely heard about it from some of your students. And yeah, I, that the Galapagos is special. I thought, you know, Greg hasn't done fish, so maybe I need to do some fish there.
And it's great you're doing it.
That's what I'm doing.
I hope you're are you going back this year?
Yeah, going back in actually July, August, and then again in January. So we're not going to overlap, unfortunately. But
oh, maybe in July.
Well, it'll be end of July. You said you're going to be mid-July, I think, right?
Yeah, 15th to about the 23rd.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, like I mean, there's not room in like Florida. There's not room in the Galapagos for us either.
Yeah, I'm getting that kind of sense, which I'm, you know, makes me sad. But you know,
yeah. What about the book?
Yeah, the book. Let's talk about the book. So before we talk about the Aquarium Fish Medicine Handbook that Greg and I co-authored that just came out, I did want to at least reference the fact that Greg is an award-winning author as well as a veterinarian and pioneer, and has done a lot to forward the profession, including, you know, his pretty influential and important invertebrate medicine book, which I think is on its third edition right now, right?
Yeah.
So I was honored when Greg asked me to co-write this book. So yeah, talk about the Aquarium Fish Medicine Handbook, Greg.
Yeah, I'd love to. So we talk about pioneers. I mentioned some names, and Greg and Linda Harrison are really pioneers in the area of what we call exotic animal medicine or non-domestic or companion zoo animal. They wrote avian medicine textbooks going, I think the first edition was in the mid 80s. And then they started a company called the Zoological Education Network. And this would have been in the 90s. It was a big deal. They had their own conference every year in Southern Florida, and they put out a journal called Exotic DVM Magazine. Exotic DVM Magazine was a very clinically focused journal. There was some peer review, but it was really practical. Hey, I'm a busy clinician. And, you know, this is before the internet was big. And so it really helped to have these one-pager articles sometimes with nuts and bolts. How do I hold it? How do I get blood out of it? What are the drugs and dosages? And they actually had this handbook series, which was like a multi-ring binder. And you could buy these little inserts, 50, 60 page inserts, and put them in this handbook. I have a couple on my shelf. So it's probably 20 years ago, Linda reached out and said, hey, how would you like to put together a little handbook of ornamental fish for our series? It doesn't have to be big and involved, just something that a veterinarian could have quickly turned to, like between clients, how much MS-222 or how do I get a skin biopsy? And so I did it. It was very modest, about, I think it was 54 pages. I looked at it the other day. And, you know, the years went by and the Zoological Education Network, I mean, there have been some other kind of groups and things that have replaced it as our part of the profession has developed. Exotic animals, amphibians and reptiles and small mammals and even fish all have their own boards now. You can be an American Board of Veterinary Practitioner specialist. So things have changed and evolved. And then, I don't know, it's probably, I don't remember, Roy, it was 3 years ago. Does that sound about right? I'd have to look.
Sure. Let's go with 3 years ago.
Let's go with three. It could have been a tick more.
Yeah.
But CRC Press reached out to me, and I guess they knew about the handbook. And they said, hey, how would you like to revise that handbook? And I've edited a number of textbooks, and it's a lot of work. And I thought to really bring this handbook up to current standards with the information we have now is going to be a pretty big task. And I reached out to the Harrisons, and they are so generous. And they said, Greg, you just take that thing and do whatever you want with it. You know, you don't have to pay for the rights, because I didn't, you know, usually publishers own the rights. They said, you can just use it. And it was very nice of them. And then I thought, okay, I don't think I can do this justice by myself. It needs a cleanup hitter. You need the home run hitter of ornamental fish, and none other than Roy. And I reached out to Roy and I said, Roy, how would you like to co-author this handbook with me? And I think I probably sent you the handbook and we looked it over, and Roy really made it what it is. I'm his co-author, but I really should be like subscript co-author because the amount of work he put into it.
But not true at all.
I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, no, not true at all, Greg. Obviously, you did a ton of work, and I'm proud of it as well. I guess maybe talk about when you did kind of the outline many, many years ago in the, you know, the Harrison and Harrison format kind of the changes. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about some of the differences and some of the maybe additions.
Yeah, so originally it was pretty minimal, black and white, no color. I think there were just a couple diagrams. I know one was a tube feeding a fish that I had a biological illustrator do. You know, it had references, the sort of references of the time. I think it, well, I know it was, it came out in 2006, right? So that's 18 years ago. And really, it means it probably was based on information that's 20 years old. So it was fairly basic in terms of it. Think about an outline, like a notes outline you might get in vet school or at a CE conference. You know, bullet points, a few paragraphs. But now it's really what Roy did exceeded any expectations I ever had for the handbook. Now it's almost 300 pages. It's got a formulary, a detailed formulary. Before, I think my formulary was one table on one little page. It's richly illustrated with color. Most of those images are from Roy and his contacts in the Florida tropical fish industry. We've got pretty detailed sections on diagnostics, including imaging like radiology, CT, ultrasound, and really, really detailed sections on surgery, infectious diseases, complete with images of the, all the major parasites. So I sort of thought it would end up being like a little handbook. Like I have little hands that you could put in my little hand.
Nice.
But it's really, I mean, I think not that I'm boasting, but man, this thing really came together as a full-blown comprehensive fish textbook. And there are some great books out there. I mean, Michael Stoskov's book, Ed Noga's book, Steve Smith, Helen Roberts, Hatfield and Clayton. And they all have their strengths. And, you know, most fish vets have them all on their shelf. Nick St. Earn. But the way this thing came together, and I think the best part of it is, and I'm not sure how CRC did it, but you can buy it for about $40, the soft cover. So it's richly illustrated in color. And I have to have a shout out to my wife, Diane, who really helped design the cover.
Definitely. Definitely. Thank you, Diane.
Yeah. She helped with the images and the color pattern and everything. She's really good at that. In fact, she helped design the covers of at least two of the invertebrate medicine books. So that really helped. But yeah, I mean, I'm bragging on it, partly because it's mostly Roy's book, but it's really good. And I'm even buying extra copies to give away.
Definitely mine and Greg's book. And yeah, I told Greg already as well. I think we've got plans for the second edition, but I think the first edition will hopefully have a pretty good run. And I think there's, you know, I think one of the goals we had was definitely keeping it as much detail as we could, but short enough that you didn't have to kind of wade through too much to get basic information that you would need, whether you're, you know, maybe an advanced hobbyist or aquarist or a veterinarian who's going to be working with, you know, with these folks. So yeah, I think that's kind of one of the strengths of the book.
Yeah. And I think one thing that keeps it detailed but concise is that we really focus on ornamental fish.
Yep.
So it's focused freshwater and marine, but, you know, at the public aquarium level, the hobbyist level, the aquaculture level, but we really don't kind of spread out into salmonids or tilapia or catfish or anything like that. We stay focused on ornamentals, tropicals, display fish. And I think that's one of the strengths of the book.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Definitely want to thank our guest, Dr. Greg Lubard, my very, very good close friend and mentor, for making the time. Greg, appreciate it.
Wow, this is really special, Roy. And hey, man, anytime I can spend an hour with you is a happy day.
Ditto, ditto. I want to thank our producer, Mark Winter, for making the show possible. Greg, I did mention that I might ask you for some words of wisdom for people, maybe those interested in working with aquarium fish or aquatic animals as a career, you know, husbandry or you know, even health. Do you have any words of wisdom for those folks?
Absolutely, I do. So don't be intimidated by the breadth of species or the different kinds of life support systems and environments. If you have an interest and you're willing to work hard, you're enthusiastic and you communicate well with people, then there'll be lots of opportunities for you. We're fish veterinarians as a group are very inclusive. We're fun. There's so much work to be done that people, there aren't really like TERFs and things like that. We really love mentoring younger people. And I would say, get your hands wet. I've never had ichthyology. I'm not a hobbyist, but I made it a point to try to learn through hands-on, through connecting with people, experts, taking CE opportunities. and just teaching myself things. So I would say, you know, we've had almost any major aquarium now has at least two veterinarians. I had a student, a former student last week, who's an ER doctor, and she's pretty amazing. And she reached out to me because she was working with an elasmobranch and she had never done that. But she said, I'm willing to try. Can you help me? And I did. I FaceTimed with her and helped her get a sample and helped her get blood. And that kind of stuff is good for everybody. And she probably has a whole new level of confidence working with fish after just one case. So I think if you have the interest and the will, people like Roy and myself and our other colleagues are willing to nurture that interest.
Very true. Very true. Thanks, Greg. Please be sure to check out Greg's web links, which will be found on his Aquarium Mania episode page. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy@petliferadio.com. That's DRROY @petliferadio.com. Until next time, please visit your local aquarium stores and keep your tanks clean and your fish healthy. And definitely check out Greg and my newly released guide, The Aquarium Fish Medicine Handbook, which is available at most online bookstores.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.